Welcome to the Chariot TechCast. I'm Ken Rimple. In this episode, we listen to an interview I recorded last week with Scott Fraser, Chief Technology Officer and co-founder of Portico Systems. Portico runs some of the largest healthcare provider networks in the country. We spoke to Scott about the need for flexible systems and their Jython-based scripting platform, large-scale memory issues on 64-bit virtual machines, the use of the Netscape Visual Library, and more. One quick note, if you haven't already signed up, the Emerging Technologies for the Enterprise Conference is being held on Wednesday and Thursday, March 26th and 27th, at the Drexel University campus. More details can be found at www.phillyemergingtech.com. Now, on to the interview. Welcome back to Chariot's TechCast. I'm Ken Rimple. I'm joined today by Scott Fraser of Portico.
Hi, Ken. How you doing?
Good. How are you? Tell me a little bit about Portico and how you guys got your start.
Okay. Well, I founded the company with Ned Moore, who's our CEO now, about 11 years ago. We were in Conshohocken until just last year we moved to Bluebell. We've been growing over the years slowly and steadily. We just closed a Series B round of financing with Safeguard and Edison. We had taken an initial round, I think it was 2006. So we'd actually managed to survive the 90s bubble and everything and get through that. And a large part of that was because we were really actually doing a lot of sort of hand-to-mouth services in terms of the cash flow. We had a lot of services going on as well as product development. And we just managed to, we actually had a business plan and we were making real money, and that kept us going. It was a little tough in the late 90s, even around here in the Philly area, in terms of losing people to the offers from the other companies who were going to maybe have an IPO and all that kind of thing. But we got through it, and looking back, the team we've got at Portico today is just, it's an amazing team, and I have to pinch myself every day I come to work, because in terms of the quality of what's going on there and the people that I work with, it's really amazing. Now, of course, we have some long, old connections with Chariot. Don Coleman, who's now here at Chariot, and I were, I think Don was probably employee number 4 or 5 or 6, I don't know. He was there at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And he's one of those guys that I can say I knew him when he almost probably could barely program, and I watched him become a complete Java stud. And and then he moved on during that 90s craze and eventually ended up at Chariot. But I remember Don and I working long hours for probably 1997 or 98, basically Java 102, writing the first versions of the software that has now become the Portico platform. And it was all Java applets, Oracle's at the time 7 on the back end, Java applets, and we had a lot of servlets. We were using the Sun's Java web server.
Oh my.
Which was a nightmare. And we also had some Mod J Serve Apache stuff going on. We actually had some MySQL stuff going on too. We were early adopters of Linux and Java and handhelds, and had a lot of fun technology going on. And then of course later years we actually had some of your guys help us out from time to time when we needed to augment our engineering group. Mm-hmm. And it's been great. So
you've seen Java from the very, very beginnings until what it is now, which is kind of a very strong VM with multiple languages. And when we were talking earlier, you had mentioned Jython. Mm-hmm. So I guess the first thing I'd like to talk about is, you are using Jython, and you've been using it for a very long time. Mm-hmm. What does it give you that just programming in Java and something, typical Java and stored procedure mm-hmm. code would not give you?
Well, Jython has been a great technology for us. When you look at the first versions of that software, like I was talking about back in the 1.0 days, when we needed to implement, or we tried to avoid the word customize at the time, but if our customers, we had, in the very early years, we had basically three customers. We had one really large one and two medium to small size healthcare companies that were our primary customers. And anytime they came to us and said, listen, we need a business rule where if a doctor signs up for our network, they must have a service location in the state of New Jersey, for example. The way we would actually implement that would be either custom Java code that would then get put into the custom build for the customer, or we would implement it as a database trigger since we were using Oracle. And we had long ago, I decided from the very beginning, we were just going to jump on the Oracle bandwagon, and that way we were able to leverage a lot of the PL SQL, the stored functions, the stored procedures, and everything. So we didn't have to be database agnostic. We tried to be for a while. We actually did support SQL Server for a while, but we eventually snapped out of that, and now we're just all Oracle. But anyways, so by the 4.0 release, it was really becoming a major burden. So we had a sales opportunity that we were dealing with, and what it kind of helped crystallize, and you look at, we were an entrepreneurial company from the very beginning, and a lot of the innovation that we've done has been driven by our customers. It was becoming really apparent that if we were going to grow and scale, we needed to have the same Java code deployed at all of our customers. We just couldn't keep maintaining all these different versions of the software. So we added the rules, what we call the rules engine, which, as I was telling you before the show, isn't a classic rules engine. That's our marketing, our branding speak for it. It is a business rules engine in that our customers use it to implement the business rules that drive their business, like the example I was giving you. So I was pretty sure we needed to use some kind of a dynamically typed scripting language. I didn't really know what to use. I looked at Groovy, I looked at Jython, I looked at a bunch of other ones, and I remember actually I was having conversations with Don from Chariot, and he was really excited about Jython, so that had some weight there. And eventually, after I did some benchmarking and trying out of the different technologies, we settled on Jython. And we're still using Jython 2.1, which of course has been out and stable now for 6 years or something. But we've managed to make it perform and do amazing things with it. In the old days, it was just those simple business rules, which were basically attached to our business objects. We had our own data access object layer that we had written long before EJBs, long before JPA, any of the stuff that you've got today. No, there was no such thing as Hibernate, you know.
Yeah.
So we had our own data access layer that we had then layered around this concept of business rules. So if I have a screen, and we had a separation of architectural layers. So we had the presentation layer, we had the business objects, and actually the first versions of our software could run under CORBA. So the business objects in the very, very early builds were actually CORBA objects. So anyways, the way we would actually then configure the product for these customers now is we would attach the business rules to the business object. So I would take the provider network business object and then attach this rule, which was written in a scripting language that's basically the Jython syntax or Python syntax, you know, using Jython, but actually uses the Portico APIs as well as Java APIs. And I would attach it to that business object, and then those rules are actually stored in a rules repository in the product. So we used some scholarly, you know, we referred to a bunch of books on how do you properly design a rules repository and everything. And actually, the way our backend is designed, we could use other scripting languages.
Mm-hmm.
So I fully expect someday we might support Ruby, JRuby. We might support other maybe Groovy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where we'll head, but the way the backend was designed was to not just have to use Jython, but it could theoretically use other scripting languages or even straight Java.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept the Java in there because we weren't quite sure if we were going to be able to make the Jython interpreters perform the way we needed to, and we did. We were able to make that happen. The key thing was figuring out how to get the Jython to compile down to bytecode and have intelligent caching and versioning and everything else. And then also the other big aspect was figuring out how to make it perform in a highly multi-threaded concurrent environment. I think one of the benefits and also one of the pain points for us in the early years was right off the bat we had a really large customer, one of the largest size plans in the country. I think right now we have 5 of the top 30 plans as customers, and this was one of them right from the early years. So we immediately were being faced with problems of supporting hundreds of users and performing well and having software that could handle, you know, lots of transactions, lots of OLTP style applications, lots of ad hoc reporting, lots of business rules firing. And Jython itself is not designed to handle multiple threads. If you take a Jython interpreter and you're holding it in your hand, you really can only have one thread go in there and run some Jython.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's not designed to handle multiple threads. And there's a lot of things we learned about how to make it work. Probably one of the most interesting things is just the fact that the import subsystem of Jython is heavily synchronized. So let's say you have 200 threads all come in and they all need to run a Portico business rule. If that business rule has an import statement at the top of it, which is, you know, normal Jython syntax, they're all going to end up synchronizing and getting lined up in a queue mm-hmm. as that import is executed over and over again for each one. Even though they're separate instances of the Jython interpreter, they get stacked up. So we have a lot of things we put into the Portico product, like your imports and all of your sort of pre-initialization stuff are put into initialization scripts that just get run once. And so then when you get down to running the rules, you're just running the predicate logic that that rule has. You're not doing all of that setup stuff.
Right, you pre-burned all of that in the configuration.
Exactly. And then we do a lot of trickery to take the namespace that was in the interpreter, basically baseline it, and then run a rule, and then basically flip that namespace back to the state it was right before the rule runs, because those interpreters are put into pools. We're using Apache Commons, you know, pooling mm-hmm. mechanisms behind the scenes. So I might have in a typical server, I might have like a pool of 500 of these things. And as those rules engines are being passivated, you have to, you know, re-baseline them and get them back to a known state. So there's a lot of sort of back-end stuff we do. But the end result has been, we started with the rules on the business objects. We ended up using it in our web app framework that I was telling you a little bit about, which is we call WebLink. And we also now use it in some of the other products that maybe we'll talk about. But that we mm-hmm. we actually are at a point now where we can take business logic that's written in this Jython syntax and have it execute in milliseconds. And that's pretty impressive. And we can have, you know, I've sat in front of a RS6000 and had 5,000 transactions a second running on four cores. And each one of those transactions is running in like 16 milliseconds or less, and that's including the network round trip time. Like that might be a load test with Grindr. Mm-hmm. Or our customers in production will be running millions of transactions through a similar stack, sometimes a Sun T2000 with the 8 cores and the 4 threads per core kind of thing going on. So you can really, if you do everything right, you can actually make this dynamically typed scripting language really, really perform. I mean, you can also saturate the CPUs, but you can be getting some very impressive throughput from just a single server, and it's been really exciting, and we've enjoyed our relationship with Jython. I'm now looking at the next. I think that they're on 2.2 now, and it's been great to see the pickup. I was really excited to see the announcements from Sun that they hired a couple of Jython guys a couple of weeks ago. I got to tell you, I've been banking on that for a while, because we have our own tools that we use to edit the rules, and we have color syntax highlighting and everything. But I'll be honest with anybody, it's not a NetBeans or an IntelliJ. It's not that rich. And if we could take if NetBeans comes out with first class support like they've done for Ruby, mm-hmm. if they do that with Jython, I would fully expect Portico to be looking to leverage that technology in whatever way we can, according to the licenses. To sort of make the environment that the people who configure our product with a lot richer.
As a matter of fact, I think that I forget the person's name at Sun, but the Java Posse had a show recently, and they were kind of hiding which the next language was they were planning on supporting. And I believe it's
Tor Norby.
That's probably who it is. And he said, "Yeah, well, it's going to be Python, because it was a lot of things were kept quiet because of all the deals they were making to get these guys on board."
That's awesome. I should have made some bets at Portico, because there was, you know, I mean, we've been sort of agonizing over what's the right thing. Do we go Eclipse RCP? Do we go NetBeans? Do we keep trying to build our own? Do we release something that's open source that's using GPL code? Because we could make a pretty decent. Actually, Don has done some great work here with, you know, he'd done some pop-ups and some context-sensitive pop-up stuff in mm-hmm. his Jython editor.
Code complete and things
code
like that.
Completion. Yeah. And we did some similar work, some of it inspired by Don, some of it based on Don's work that he did when he was working with us. But the problem was, it's all GPL. So it's stuff that Portico can't actually sell. Now, we could provide it to a customer, and we could say, hey, look, here's this little open source thing we've put together. It's just a tool that interacts with the Portico backend, mm-hmm. pulls the rules out, lets you edit them. We've never done that, but it's an idea we've kicked around. And about a year ago, when I saw what was happening with JRuby, I said, they've got to do this with Python.
Yeah.
So, and I'm about 5 episodes behind on the Java Posse.
Mm-hmm.
So
you'll be pleased to hear that. I'm
really excited to hear that.
That, my favorite language, Groovy, they place that in the developer's build.
Yeah.
So you can install the Groovy plugin.
I just heard now that's the last one I listened to, I think, was I forget the guy's name, but the Groovy guy, the mm-hmm. interview of him.
Graham Roche.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I need to revisit Groovy. My whole pushback on Groovy when I first looked at it was one of our COO, Sam Upala, one of his directives to me when we were talking about, you know, scripting languages and how we're going to keep using them was he wanted to make sure that whatever technology we settled on was as easy as possible for folks to use. We have a lot of, when we roll out Portico, we're usually working with like an Accenture or IBM or FCG or some other partner, and there's going to be, during the implementation phase of the project, we're going to have teams offshore in India or Manila or various places, and we had to make the tooling of our platform as easy to use. And my problem with Groovy when I looked at it was, which was a couple of years ago, or mm-hmm. maybe even 3 years ago, way back when it was just when it just came out, was that it looked so much like Java that I didn't think that was really going to convey that message to our customers and to our implementation partners. And I knew that when I showed this to Sam, he would say, that looks just like Java, because that's what I said. Yeah. And so that's one reason why we stuck with Jython, because, you know, the Python syntax is incredibly easy to use.
And it's quite terse, right? I mean, you don't have a lot.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You need to type.
I always like to tell this story about, I've run into Eric Raymond, who's a local open source person in this Philly region. Mm-hmm. I've run into him a couple times many years ago. And the first time I met him was at PhilCon, which is the science fiction convention. Not that I was attending. Don't get me wrong. My wife was there writing a story about PhilCon for, mm-hmm. I forget, for the magazine in the Enquirer or something like that. Mm-hmm. She was basically functioning as a stringer writing articles. And so I said, well, if you're going to PhilCon, I need to go with you, because I can't let you go to that alone. So we went down there. It was at the Adams Mark Hotel, and I remember I was wandering around, and I look into this, I forget the name of the ISP, because the guy, a lot of people would know his name, and I'm completely blanking on it, but mm-hmm. there's this ISP that was out in Westchester that provided ISP services. Anyways, I walk by, and I see Eric Raymond in there, and I'm like, oh my gosh. So I go in there, and I start talking to him. I'm like, you're Eric Raymond. And he starts... This was probably 1997 or 98. He starts gushing to me about, he just came back from, like, I don't know where Guido lives. Does he live in?
I'm not sure, yeah.
Okay, he's in Europe somewhere or something. Mm-hmm. But he had just come back from some convention or something, and he's like, I got to tell you about this language, Python. It's awesome. Blah, 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 blah. And he's like just spouting off about it. And, you know, little did I know. And, you know, I listened to him. I'm like, I will definitely check it out. And I checked it out, but it's amazing to think that a few years later it became a key aspect of my company's, you know, product. So, you know, it's a great, simple, easy to learn language. Mm-hmm. So now
one of the things we were talking about a little bit was that you have this NetBeans visual library based application,
right?
And that you're using basically behind the scenes, you're running your script mm-hmm. interpreter that's based in Jython as mm-hmm. well. I haven't talked to anybody about the NetBeans Visual Library,
okay.
So a good overview probably for everyone who's listening
yeah.
would help.
Well, so our constant push, some of the metrics that we give ourselves is, in the next release of the software, can we reduce the amount of configuration effort that's required by, you know, 30%? Like, let's aim for that. So the latest release of our software has brought in a lot more, has increased the number of, we had already had a lot of GUI paradigms where, like, if you go into Portico and you want to add things to it, there's a lot of stuff you do from a GUI, okay, from those swing-based applets, which I forget if we talked about that, but we have, mm-hmm. for some of the internal users, we've got Swing, and external users, we've got, you know, HTML, Ajax stuff. But anyways, there's a lot of stuff that's done in a GUI. Now, some of the more complex stuff, you have to drop down into PCL. If you have a complex business role...
Which is your scripting language.
Yeah, you may have to use a chunk of PCL to implement it.
Mm-hmm.
With our integration engine, you can do pretty much most everything you need from XML, but if you wanted to have a really complex decision tree where you're going to do some phonetic matching, some word distance searching, some, you know, some fuzzy matching of data, apply a confidence score, in the earlier releases of the software, you would do that in PCL.
Mm-hmm.
This latest release now, we took the NetBeans Visual Library, which used to be called Graph, and they came out with their 1.0 release sometime last year. But this is basically, if you're familiar with NetBeans, the mobile developer's toolkit and some of those other GUI things they've got, like the SOA, the Beeple design screen. These are the classes that they used to build those screens internally. So they're very robust and very well tested in their production quality. And they basically packaged it all up and said, here it is as its own little thing. Now, it comes bundled with NetBeans, but if you do enough digging, you find the instructions on here. You need this jar and this jar. You pull them out, and then you can, you know, we don't use NetBeans internally we use, well, we do for just a little bit of proof of concept stuff. Like Matisse is awesome for doing a quick swing layout. But but most of our developers use, our Portico's developers use JetBrains or use IntelliJ. I use IntelliJ, I love it. Some of our partners obviously use Eclipse, and some might use NetBeans. But anyways, the you can pull it out and you can use it, and you don't have to be in NetBeans to use their visual library. So it's not a swing component library. However, it can be embedded on a container in Swing. So what happens now is when you go into some of our tools, some of these Swing-based applications, there's tabs on the screen that will have a canvas on them, and it looks like Visio, and you basically drag and drop boxes. And actually, we have, for example, probably the best example is we have BPMN notation, where you can basically create a standard BPMN workflow model. You can have swim lanes and a pool with swim lanes, and you can have the start and the stop and the boxes and the decision points. And what you're saving when you save that to Portico is you're actually saving 2.0 XPITL compliant XML. Now, there's some extended attributes in there, which is valid XPITL according to the schema. They have constructs in the schema to allow a vendor to add additional metadata into the XPITL. But when you save that visual model, it's sort of like a Beeple. XPITL is sort of like Beeple plus visual stuff. Is probably the best way to think about it. So we've brought that visual paradigm to the product, and the only way we were able to do it was by using, well, it's not the only way, but the quickest and path of least resistance was to use NetBeans Visual Library, and we've really enjoyed it. It's made putting together those screens a lot easier than it would have been if we had to write all the code ourselves, and I was very excited when they came out with that. So I would, if anybody's doing Swing, or again, it's not Swing, but you embed it on top of a Swing application. But if you're doing a rich client Java application and you want to have graphs, directed graphs, like nodes connected with lines, and you don't want to have to write all the code that worries about laying them out, you can really put something pretty impressive together with the NetBeans Visual Library.
That's great. Great. Now, also, you mentioned you have hundreds and hundreds of threads running concurrently.
Yeah.
And you have large-scale clients. I mean, you've got some of the biggest healthcare systems, I'm sure, that you're hosting and providing network access to. So talking about the VMs and kind of like a large-scale VM support,
yeah,
what kind of challenges do you run into?
And
what kind of platforms do you end up rolling out?
That's a great question. When we initially put our toes into the water of some of this big... One of the things that happened right away was when we started getting involved in claims adjudication processing, which is a real critical process of our customers, we started confronting SLAs that were at a whole order of magnitude twice over what you would deal with a web application.
And I'm assuming some of that is because you get people coming into emergency rooms, critical care.
No, actually, yeah, you know what? Yeah, let me clarify really quick. Our customers are the Blue Cross Blue Shields, the healthcare payers.
Okay.
We're not on the clinical side. We're on the side that's basically selling the services of a network of providers to their members.
Okay. I understand now.
So they're the ones when the claims come in, you go see your doctor, the doctor submits a claim to the healthcare plan.
Yeah.
The plan has to figure out, okay, what contract, what this, what that, is this the right provider? Do we actually have them? Was that member really allowed to see them? And then pay the claim. So the processes behind that curtain, you would be stunned at how messy they can be, okay? And when Ned and I first started looking at this market, it was like we immediately saw huge opportunities there. And that's actually part of our whole business plan, is we're trying to make healthcare more affordable for everybody. There's a lot of opportunity out there. It's sort of like the financial services industry many, many years ago. There's huge leaps and bounds of innovation enabled progress that our customers are making today by buying Portico, and we hope to bring. We've literally just dealt with one slice of the provider network operations part of their business, which is sort of like, and I'll be honest with you, this is a market we actually have developed. I mean, we basically made this market. I'm sure we have. You could argue that we have some competitors, but the whole concept of provider network operations has been something we've pioneered. So. Anyway, so we've gotten into claims now, and that's a whole different ballgame than a web page. Your SLA with a web page might be every page must come back within 2 seconds.
Right.
Okay, Not a problem. We were doing that. We were doing way under that with our Jython-based web application framework mm-hmm. And hundreds of users on just four cores. No big deal. Now we were dealing with, okay, I need 20 milliseconds or less turnaround time on every transaction, and there's going to be X million of them a day.
Uh-huh.
And actually, millions a day, if you spread it out, if you look at how many you have to handle a second, that's not actually a big number. But what got really tough was you're dealing with legacy systems who have batch windows. So it's not really 9 million a day. It's actually 9 million in 2 hours.
Right,
you know,
middle of the night right. sometime, yeah.
So the problem we got into was Oracle on the back end is not going to be the way to solve this problem. So we built our own IP. This is a in-memory database. It's patent pending. And I fortunately got to work on a lot of it. That was a lot of fun building. We put all of the data and business logic into memory in this in-memory database technology. We call it hypermemory. And then there's integration stuff wrapped around it. And that's you can basically call our business logic or get our data over SOAP or XML over HTTP or RMI, CORBA, JMS, all of the standard enterprise integration protocols, we support them. And we also have our own proprietary TCP/IP-based application protocol. So you can open up a socket to us and then send transactions back and forth over that socket. So
in a way, an enterprise service bus, almost.
Yeah. And there's a lot of aspects of this where we could take that technology and bundle it as an ESB, but that's not our business plan. Isn't to make a commodity what it will eventually be a commodity product. We're a niche, you know. We're focused on using this technology to solve this specific business problem, you know, within, that's our hedgehog principle, you know. The problem we ran into right away, and we were dealing with this actually way back when there was only 32-bit JVMs, but was how do you get all that data into memory, so 64-bit
right.
Java. So where we ended up was it's driven by whatever 64-bit JVMs are out there. So, you know, you could do 64-bit Java on AS400, you could do it on Solaris, you could do it on AMD Linux, you can do it on Windows now, Intel, Intel and I'm sure AMD.
HP, right? I think didn't they
have a 64-bit? Let's see. HP have a 64-bit JVM? They might.
Mm-hmm. But platforms like that.
I would guess JRocket too. And then some of mm-hmm. the other vendors' JVMs, I would guess JRocket was probably available as a 64-bit JVM. But that kind of drove, we got to a point where we had to have a 64-bit JVM, we had to have a 64-bit operating system.
Mm-hmm.
So our most popular, you know, in-house dev stack would be probably something like SUSE or, you know, honestly, even just any Linux distro that supports 64-bit. Now, if you want to have something that's certified, you know, you're going to look at SUSE or Red or RHEL or something like
right.
that. But
mm-hmm.
Linux, 64-bit Linux, 64-bit Java performs awesome. A lot of our customers have us on Solaris. Some have us on AIX, and some have us on. We have one production customer who has that 64-bit stack on Windows 2003 server. So some of the challenges we've dealt with are, if you've ever used Visual GC or watched a heap, you know, and done memory work, imagine doing it on a scale of 16 to 32 gigs in one heap. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
First of all, if you're using something like JProfiler, which is one of my favorite tools,
mm-hmm.
you're going to need to be running that on a pretty beefy box.
Yeah, because it's not going to be able to keep
up.
Yeah,
so, of course, we have experimented out the wazoo with all of those. If you look at all those weird hotspot JVM flags, all the different types of garbage collectors and the tunings, we've tried them all.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that out of the gate now, what we recommend to our customers is to use the concurrent garbage collectors. And by the way, we're also in production on IBM's Java, too. So.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been interesting to see the performance and sort of the differences in the flags between Sun and IBM.
Mm-hmm.
IBM has its own concurrent garbage collector, just like Sun has the concurrent garbage collector that most people would be familiar with, and just seeing sort of how they perform differently. The great thing about the concurrent garbage collector is you can have massive amounts of heap churning where your old generation is filling up literally every few, let's say 10, 20 seconds, you're filling up that old generation. And of course, in our heap, that old generation could be 10 gigs to 20, 25 gigs, okay?
Wow.
Now, you can imagine with your standard garbage generational garbage collector, when you hit that full GC, the whole JVM is going to lock up, and it's not going to lock up for 200 milliseconds. It's going to lock up for 20 seconds.
Until it dumps all that memory out.
I mean, it takes a long time, right? So, probably our recommended garbage collector would be to use the concurrent, because the concurrent will keep up with pretty much any load. The disadvantage, of course, is you get typically overall maybe 20% less throughput, but you never have a long pause.
The pause is right.
Right. So, and it's better to start our customers off with that garbage collector, and then if they really want to kick things up a notch, they can go to parallel, or they could even go to the generational, and they're going to see more performance rather than have them start on the default garbage collector and then be disappointed when the overall throughput goes down because they have to go to concurrent to avoid the long pauses. The other thing that we're excited about is we're certified on Java 5 right now. When we took that same stack and load tested it under Java 6, now the initial release of Java 6, when we used some of those obscure flags, we got some hotspot crashes. You know, like send this bug report to Sun, one of those ugly things.
You're one of the few people running that large of a VM.
Yeah, I think we were really on the bleeding edge there. So and also with that number of threads, like our typical load test is going to be anywhere from like 500 to maybe 1,000 threads all pounding away. So you've got all your cores saturated and you've got this enormous heap and all this stuff's going on. And the Java 6 would, with the default garbage collector, was like 15%, maybe 20% faster overall, just out of the box. Like just take
no tuning.
Yeah, no tuning, no changes. We were immediately running a lot faster than Java 5. So they just, I think six just came out for the
Release three or whatever it was, or
is
two.
It three?
I forget what the number is.
Something just came out like today or yesterday or this week. And I believe it's a lot more stable. So we need to revisit that. But what I fully expect to happen is that our customers, especially some of our Solaris customers, when they upgrade to Java 6, they're going to right away have like 15 to 20% better throughput for free. And there's nothing better than performance for free. No new hardware, just upgrade to Java 6, and we're going to be able to pump through, you know, X number more of transactions, and that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Great. Let's see. So, futures for you guys. You're running this Jython stack in the language, interpreted language. You're maybe looking at multiple VMs, and you know, I'm glad Sun finally got around to realizing that Java's virtual machine is the key, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to just the language, because now they're hiring people with Python and I forget the other one that they hired, JRuby, right? They load some people in from there. So I'm glad to see they actually caught up with you. But in addition to that, you know, what's in the future? I see that you were talking a little bit about Juice earlier as an inversion control container.
Well, yeah, so that's one of the reasons why, I've been in IT for over 20 years, and it's one of the things I always tell people about working in IT is it's always, if you're the type of person who likes to always be learning new things, that's what you want to do. And I'm definitely an information junkie, so I've enjoyed having to reinvent myself year over year, and it's been really fun to see the progress of Java. So you go back to 102 and you look at where we're at today with generics and annotations and the concurrency packages and all the awesome things that are in Java 5 and forward now. And it's quite a change. Now, the big challenge for us is we have a million plus lines of Java code that has some of which has been around since JDK 102, and the challenge of refactoring and enhancing that code base to support these new features. And I was telling you right before the podcast how just before this last release, we brought in generics and nullable and not null annotations into our business objects layer. And that involved touching probably 350 Java classes. The beauty, of course, is you've got these great tools these days like IntelliJ, which can help automate a lot of that refactoring and make it as painless as possible. But that's one of these things that keeps me coming back to work and keeps me excited. Juice, we'd evaluated, we needed dependency injection, and that's all we needed. And I knew we were going to be going all Java 5 with this last release of Portico. So one of the reasons we steered towards Juice was versus Spring or some other, Pico container or something like that, was annotations based, which caught my eye. And also it was just dependency injection, and that's really all we needed. I didn't want to get the kitchen sink. And Spring didn't actually have it. Now they do now. Today, obviously, they've made great progress. So if I had to make the decision today, I'd probably give Spring a longer look. But I'm kind of one of these guys who, I've been around so long, I know that you can waste a lot of time getting emotional and sort of religious about your technology decisions. The fact is, any good team, it's really about the people, any good team of people can make things work for the customers using, you know, whatever they've got. It doesn't, you know, it's not the end of the world if you choose, you know, one framework over another. It's more important that you get the job done for the customer, you know, and not waste a lot of energy getting worked up. And so one of the things that we have tried to do over the many years is to not make emotional / religious / philosophical decisions about what technologies we use. And then once we choose them, we don't look back.
Right.
Because, you know, there's no point in agonizing about it. So anyways, we've started using Juice for dependency injection, and I hope to eventually eliminate a lot of the patterns that we've got in the code. We have a lot of singletons and things that are from that original source code base that's been, you know, the great thing about our source code is it's been in production for 10, 11 years. So a lot of this code has been around and is tried and true, but there's also a lot of patterns in there that will make us more agile if we can get them out. So I hope to get to a point where when we deploy Portico, and also when we're testing it specifically, actually testing is probably the biggest thing on my mind when I'm thinking about Juice and dependency injection. I want us to be more easily testable. We have tons of automated, you know, JUnit tests that run in our automated build and everything, but it is complicated to take an enterprise scale application that has a relational database on the back end and automate tests. Now, virtualization has brought up some new opportunities and has made that easier, but still at the same time, getting the configuration of the software and having that all happen magically.
Seed databases and all of that as well.
Yeah, it's just difficult. So Juice, I think, is going to bring, I mean, we had been using Juice in the last release. We had some parts of our platform that were Java 5, and we started using Juice in them successfully. So now we're introducing it into the rest of the platform. And I believe that by the end of this year, in some of our unit testing, what's going to happen is Portico configuration will be getting assembled dynamically by, you know, more dynamically by dependency injection, versus right now we have multiple configurations and you have one ear with a properties file externalized, but there's still a lot of other pieces that have to get set up on the back end. And I don't know, I'm always working towards the testing nirvana. That's something I'm really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So I'll ask you one more question, and then I'm going to duck. Is so Ant versus Maven?
Oh,
just
yeah.
what's your take on build tools today?
You know, that's a great question. So I remember, I think it was Don and he from Chariot, and and I were having a lot of conversations about Maven. And we actually did some proof of concept works. So we got Maven up and running at Portico. And we've gotten to a size now where I can't actually say why. I mean, looking back, when we were really small, I can say, yeah, we made that decision because I made it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm basically the geek that's been around the longest at Portico, and there's a lot of decisions that were made back in the day that you could trace back to me. But you can't scale like that. And so one of the key things is, as our team's gotten bigger, is the decision-making is more distributed. And so I'm not really sure why we ended up sticking with Ant. I think what happened was we had our own automated build system that we had homegrown using Ant, and we just never jumped over to Maven. We actually use Anthill right now, which we're liking very much. We have a one-click build where we have an automated build. It's not a continuous integration, you know, constant build throughout the day kind of thing. And I don't know if our engineering department plans on eventually getting there. We had that actually going for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got this website. You go in there, you can see, okay, the build ran. Here's all the JUnit tests. You know, here's the percentage of tests that passed. You can drill down, see what failed. You can click on a button and get a build to run at Portico, and then the deployment of that build as an ear and more files, and then any sort of artifacts, which is generally this one externalized properties file, get deployed out with those artifacts get pushed out to our dev and QA servers automatically. So we've gotten to a point where it's very automated, and I think everybody's happy with it. There wouldn't be, so this is sort of the if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of thing.
Yes.
I know Maven's awesome, and the other one that was catching my eye was the one they use at Java now. What's it called? I'm blanking on the name. Java.net.
Is it Builder? There's another one out there.
I can't remember what it's called, but there's some other sort of really pretty interesting looking build tools, but honestly, we're not looking at them right now because
You have a working
system.
We have
what works.
Yep.
We're like an anthill very much. We've got a great relationship with them. I think that their tool is going to go far. So
the reason I ask also is because you have things like libraries that you mm-hmm. have to maintain. So if you're using Ant and you're using something like Ivy to manage them, or just doing them manually and checking them into your version control.
That's probably the weak point there. And that was actually why we were looking at Maven, because of a lot of the third-party libraries that we use and managing the version control mm-hmm. of them. And actually, by the way, our backend's all CVS. We haven't migrated to Subversion.
Mm-hmm.
I think we will probably migrate to something else, maybe Subversion, maybe Mercurial. Maybe something else, but what's the Linux one? Git.
Mm-hmm.
But CVS is
it's
still
a major change anyway.
Yeah, it's not something I'm looking for. I'm looking forward to the exploration and everything, but I know that when we finally do it, it's going to be a big deal.
Yeah.
The other products we use that sort of layer on top of that CVS backend is FishEye and Crucible, which are awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely love them. And we also use Jira. We have a real customized Jira that we refer to as Tracker for our issue tracking internally. Mm-hmm. So those mix. We also have Confluence too, as our internal corporate wiki. But those tools have all been. It's been a pleasure to work with all of them. I'm a little bummed that I never got to be more hands-on with Maven. So is Maven still pretty relevant out there? A lot of people using it?
It's still relevant. Mm-hmm. I think 2.0.8 is the current version.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been the big debate, at least here, when we start a project off. And you've got your camp of Ant people and your camp of Maven people. And I think what's pushing people back and looking at Ant again is the fact that Ivy exists,
mm-hmm.
which is basically dependency management for Ant.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Ivy can work with Maven repositories or any other type of repository.
Yeah.
So, it kind of takes that managing all libraries yourself out of the equation.
Right.
So it's just an interesting debate, I think, in the community. No one tool has won,
mm-hmm.
and I think if you have an Ant adherent, they're gonna cling to Ant.
Mm-hmm.
If you have someone who's gone through and gotten Maven religion, so to speak, you
mm-hmm.
know, and they understand that it's more convention over configuration.
Mm-hmm.
Put the things in these places, and you just have to wrestle a bit with the POM file, and mm-hmm. everything builds. Then they're gonna push more towards Maven. It's just,
mm-hmm.
it's an interesting kind of dichotomy in the Java kind of platform.
Yeah.
Side.
Gotta love the competition.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
We all win.
Mm-hmm. We really do. All right. Well, listen, Scott, it's been great talking to you today.
My pleasure.
I really thank you for coming down and taking the time.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you.
Special thanks today to Don Coleman for setting up this interview with Scott Fraser. Also, we are using free theme number 3 from podcastthemes.com. For more information, go visit the website at www.podcastthemes.com.